Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com. $6 gets you in the door. We're coming to the end of 2025. I thought no better time than now to bring back the editor of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter. Dave Meltzer joins us. It's a very busy week in professional wrestling, as most have been for the past 52 weeks. Dave, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's great to reconnect with you. And man, looking back at this year, Dave, I think this is one that, man, it could be maybe on a short list for one of your future releases of collections. Because when you compile all the news that happened this year, maybe not all realized this year, but in the years to come, there could be a lot of significant events that happened this year, from the start of the Netflix deal, whatever happens with WBD, the Big Data Plus panel, even things like Cena and Tanahashi's retirements. Like, there's all these things that I think in the next year or so, and maybe even beyond, I think the effects of 2025 will go beyond this year.
Long beyond this year, this is a real pivotal year in wrestling history. And you didn't even mention Hogan's death, which I think is
probably
the biggest story of the year, although it's not necessarily going to affect the business going forward. And, you know, I don't want to call it rise, but the phenomenon of CMLL's attendance this year is a giant story. And, but yeah, when you're talking about stuff, you know, and all the little things going on, different lawsuits and everything that have been, you know, covered regularly. I am almost certain that if we went through all the issues that I've done, that I've written like way more this year than in a year. I mean, it just seems like, I used to do 18 page issues, and now they're routinely 24 to 30 pages, you know, 22 to 30 pages. It's just, and it's because there's just so much news and, you know, and the expansion of, television, you know, I mean, AEW, you know, TNA, I mean, actually the deal goes through next year, but TNA getting, the new deal on AMC, you know, WWE, as you mentioned, SmackDown doing the 3-hour thing, just the whole change, the streaming, you know, streaming to television changes going on, not just in wrestling, but in every aspect of television. You know, and those, you know, we don't know where that ends up either. It's a very tumultuous time in media. You know, I mean, and not just media, you know, media rights, even media itself. I mean, which does affect wrestling, but I mean, in the big picture with politics, it's just been a really, a disturbing year, I think, in a lot of ways, that in that aspect.
Let's, cause I want to touch on a number of the points brought up there, but starting with Hulk Hogan, I would say, like, for myself personally, I don't think I have ever been reached out to by as many outlets since the Benoit tragedy in 2007. I've got to imagine for you, was that comparable in terms of just the attention it got? And I'd follow up by asking you if you were surprised at all at how much the attention got of not just this figure Hulk Hogan, but also a lot about the last 10 years of his legacy attached to the sex tape and the racist rant. That was a huge part. Like, it was not like it was a mainstream whitewashing of Hulk Hogan. Like, you looked at, you know, the good and the bad, because you can certainly take a lot from what he contributed and also how he was portrayed, especially over this last decade.
Yeah, I think in the long run, it was probably as fair as it's going to be from a mainstream standpoint of something having to do with pro wrestling, because it's such a, you know, it's such a difficult thing for outsiders to really cover. But yeah, I would say the Benoit thing, the difference with the Benoit thing is that it was like 6 weeks of hell.
Yeah.
And the Hogan thing was probably about 2 weeks. And really bad for, you know, 3 or 4 days as far as, you know, workload and attention and everything like that. But, I think that there was, I was in many ways, I was surprised at how in the big picture, it was fairer than I expected. I actually expected, you know, when he died, it would be total whitewashing. And I can't say that. I mean, there may have been places here and there that did, but most of the stuff I saw at the very least addressed, you know, all the key aspects. And there were, you know, a dozen key aspects of that story.
I think some of that is that, yes, you do have a wrestling audience, like older audience that grew up where Hulk Hogan was the be all end all for them. But I think for a lot of people out there, like these last 10 years were their biggest exposure to Hogan. Like they knew him as this reality star, ex pro wrestler that has, you know, gotten involved with this sex tape. He's attached to the Republican Party. Like,
yeah,
I think
that was big.
And the Intuit Dome in January, like that was the last real public, showcase of Hogan in front of a wrestling audience. So I think you take all that. There's a lot of people who that's the lens of which they viewed Hogan was the last 10 years as opposed to the prior 30 before that.
I mean, his last big hurrah was the Republican convention, really.
Yes.
You know, after the Intuit Dome, which was interesting. And of course, he was supposed to do the Saturday night's main event that fell through. You know, and then they didn't even book him again, which was interesting. And then there was, you know, what other, I mean, that was like, that was it. But also the other aspect is that a lot of people who worked in media who are older, you know, it's like Hulk Hogan was their childhood. So it meant a lot more to them from a wrestling standpoint than any of these other wrestlers. And he was the biggest star of our lifetime too. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't, you know, him and Inoki, but Inoki not in the United States. And, you know, so in that sense, but it was really a lot. You know, we've all been through many, many, many deaths. And like you said, like the Hogan and the Benoit were the two that were just covered the most, talked about the most intense, ever to me. Yeah.
What level of expectation do you have for the Netflix documentary series on Hogan? Like, I would think it's going to be an interesting one because you would think WWE is certainly going to be more on board with that than the McMahon series, but it's also one that, you know, you certainly have to go into all of those topics and how much they will focus on that. Like, regardless, it's going to be a series that is, you know, heavily scrutinized for however deep they go on Hogan.
Yeah. I mean, WWE involvement kind of right there is kind of like a red flag because I mean, WWE did have involvement to a degree in the Andre thing, but not that much. And in the Mr. McMahon thing, you know, shockingly little in the end. You know, I mean, they were not happy with that whatsoever.
They never promoted it. Like, yeah, like they didn't promote it at all on any of their channels. Like that was, I think, very clear that they wanted as much distance from that as possible.
And it was a bad thing, too, because of the nature of, you know, the end of Vince McMahon. You know, which was, you know, I mean, obviously the people who started when they started, when Bill Simmons people started the documentary, they had it almost done. And then they had to pretty much redo as much as they could because of what happened. But yeah, the Hogan thing, I don't think they're going to have that problem because there's no surprises that are going to come out, you know, on Hogan that haven't already come out. Although they obviously started working on it before he died. I think the thing is, and I guess this maybe be the thing that concerns me. Is that like with the McMahon documentary, I kind of knew everyone that they talked with and I knew that they really tried to be balanced. And I can't say that about the Hogan thing. Like I haven't heard names that aren't like in the kingdom. And when you have a wrestling documentary, I don't care where it's from and it's only people within the kingdom. You're getting a very biased, viewpoint. You're getting a viewpoint that's going to be as whitewashed as it could possibly be, honestly.
Can I assume you have not been interviewed for it?
I have not been interviewed. I have not been contacted for it. No, no.
Yeah. The last point on that is like how you do a Hulk Hogan documentary without Vince McMahon. Like to me is they're going to have to, I imagine they have tons at their disposal from the McMahon series for Hogan, yeah. But I can't imagine, maybe he will, but doing a new interview with Vince for this, like Vince has to be like the primary figure to me in a Hulk Hogan documentary series.
Yeah, but then there's the question with Vince is how much, you know, what kind of memory does he have left right now? And I don't know the answer to that when it comes to stuff. I mean, I know that with the, it wasn't even the Andre the Giant piece. I just remember when that thing was being filmed and talked to about Vince and Hogan and everything, and how their stories of what happened. You know, it wasn't like slight differences of a framework. It was like, I remember they would tell me, they would go like, there's two stories we're told. They cannot possibly, they're so contradictory. And it's like, you know, which one, you know, it's funny because they go like, if it came down to the two of them, which one do you believe? And I said, well, if it comes down to the two of them, I believe Vince. And they said, well, you'd be wrong then. So, because they, you know, researched the whole thing.
Well, we will see what Netflix's track record is. I'm betting that they're not beating our door down, Dave, to have us on for the Seth Rollins episode of Unreal.
Yeah.
That's going to be a frustrating episode.
That's going to be a really interesting one because I mean, the narrative that they fooled the entire world and, you know, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the year that AEW had, because this, you spoke about this just the other night, and I think you really hit it on the head. Like, it felt like, now that we look at this year and Tony Khan, how he projected himself publicly, I mean, he did not take the bait on like the head to head stuff where he could have come out all guns blazing and taking shots. He went the opposite direction. It seemed the kill him with kindness type of philosophy that I'm just going to keep my head down. I do not want to make headlines in the negative way. And it was a total, it was a strategic shift, I think, to get more goodwill on the company. Mm-hmm. And as we go into 2026, like, they kind of overcame like a lot of these head to head battles where they came out relatively unscathed, all out, did not get demolished by WrestlePalooza.
Not at all.
In Texas was a big success against two WWE shows that day. And they were also like, you know, until this big data and panel introduction, like their numbers held up really well this year with the addition of streaming. So yeah. It's like, I don't look at AEW as like at their peak, but certainly I feel like they're in a much better space than if we were talking a year ago today.
I think so. I mean, I think one of the things that it's a weird one because there's so much, you know, I think that there's so much stuff that has been used very misleadingly about the numbers. You know, I mean, it's like, WWE and AEW, I think for the most part, and I would have to go check, for the most part, when it comes to, you know, the ones that we can monitor, SmackDown and NXT and Dynamite, those three shows, because Collision, the problem with Collision is it's moved so much that it can't get any momentum. And you know, it's not just that it's a B show. If it was a B show on Saturday from 8 to 10 every single week, that's one thing, but it changes so often and people just kind of forget it. And, you know, and sometimes when it changes, there's DVR snafus, which shouldn't happen, but do. But when it comes to those, they're all down similarly. But obviously AEW, you know, is on streaming and it there's no reason that it shouldn't be down far more. So I think that that's a plus. But with the declines, it's not like, you know, I think AEW's attendance is trickling up. I mean, it's still lower than I would like to see. WWE's isn't at its peak. They're slightly falling, but it's still excellent. You know, like people, like, it's like, I do see this kind of on both sides right now that people will use the TV ratings and ignore every other metric and try to say wrestling is dying. And TV has changed, you know, like a good TV number is very different from a good TV number even 18 months ago. So, that's if you know, like there's so many signs, like when it comes to AEW of what I would call slight growth and, you know, but, you know, so it's better. I think in the big picture, that they're better off. I think that the perception is definitely better. I mean, it was very much viewed as a loser organization, I think, for a long, long time. And I don't get that feel. It's there, but it's not there. And I think Tony Khan's strategic, not falling for the bait, and my God, you know, like, better man than me, because when it, you know, I mean, he has probably been treated incredibly unfair in a business that he has bettered to such an incredible degree, because even if you don't like AEW, I mean, everyone in WWE is making, you know, probably double what they would be making if he wasn't around. And the old wrestler should at least, you know, that's the one thing. It's like, they should at least appreciate he treats the talent well. There's more jobs in wrestling. There's more really well-paying jobs in wrestling. And the top guys are making more money than ever. And that's because there's competition. If anything, the older guys should be embracing the fact, hey, it's great. There's real competition, because God knows that period from, you know, 2001 to 2018, when there was no real competition in the United States, or the best competition was TNA or at one point New Japan Pro Wrestling. It's like, you know, the business is, it's way more exciting. There's way more great wrestling. And, you know, but again, and for the, but for the talent, it's probably the best it's ever been. Schedule wise, especially. Yeah.
I think, like, it's interesting because we look at the Muhammad Ali Revival Act and the lack of boxers that seem to be realizing what's happening. It's all the MMA fighters that are the ones speaking the loudest about, hey, watch out for this. It's almost like they could give the same warning to a lot of WWE talent. Like, you want to have a distant number two that is not going to be, that is not going to be going after free agents and being competitive with you. Like, it's not a great market for talent. Like, that would be the last thing you would be rooting for, is, you know, these head-to-head battles or handicapping your opposition, because that is not the talent's opposition. It's management's opposition.
Exactly. Exactly. When I talk to the wrestlers, I always make that point. It's like, if you're a WWE wrestler, AEW is your best friend. Now, management, no. The management of both sides are very much at war. The talent, they should be, they're on a team and everything, and you want your team to do well, but every piece of talent should want both teams to do well. If you do not wish for negative to the other team. You only wish for maybe more positive to your side. Management's a different story. They'll be at each other's throats. That can't change. I mean, it could. WWE could just go, you know what? We're just going to, we hope that they elevate the industry, but that's not going to be the case. It's never been the case, never will be the case.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
Hello, hello, hello. Davey Portman here from Poison Rana. We cover NXT every Tuesday night on the Post Wrestling feed in a show we call Up Next. But we do so much more. Follow Poison Rana Pod on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts for our live Sunday show, plus our Patreon with movie reviews, retro wrestling reviews, and more. Find out everything at poisonrana.ca.
CMLL had a unbelievable year. I'm really intrigued to see what at the year end is going to be the recognition that CMLL gets from your own evidence. Like, obviously this has been a juggernaut year. How much of that do you feel has penetrated to the US audience, that like, it always feels like there's been this invisible barrier for CMLL and AAA into the US. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be a kind of referendum this year, because Lucha has been front and center, and it's, I think, impossible to deny that this year. The only barrier is that CMLL, it's a hard to access product for a lot of people.
Yeah. Because they, and I think that's a big mistake on their part, you know, and it's funny because, I'm trying to remember when this was. It was several months ago. And I know a friend of mine was talking with them and everything. And they were going like, you know, what do they need? And I said, like, number one, you know, you probably need to, you know, really try to merchandise in the United States in some form, because the one thing with the Mexican wrestling, it's very colorful, you know, the masks and the costumes and everything. And the other one is like, get that price tag down, mm-hmm. you know, because people aren't going to spend. I mean, you can subscribe to their thing for a lot less money, but you're not getting the big shows live. And the whole thing is really, like, if you really want to follow CMLL, you know, I mean, it's the Friday night shows at Arena Mexico every Friday night. That's it. They're consistent. And $35 a month is a put off. You know, I think AEW has helped. In fact, this actually would have come in June. This was right after AEW went down there. And I think that was probably the peak of CMLL interest in our country, because all of a sudden it's like, we saw Arena Mexico on TV and we saw Mystico in his element on TV and other people. And it was kind of like, okay, there's some awesome stuff here, but people can kind of dismiss it. And, you know, I mean, they don't market in this country. I mean, they're very, you know, their mentality is basically we run our five arenas or whatever the number is. And every week, and Arena Mexico is our home. I mean, like, they've sold out how many times in Arena Mexico this year? I don't know the number, but it's been an incredible run. It's the most in history. And they won't do a stadium show. I mean, they're adamant. No, it's always going to be Arena Mexico is the home. And it's like, I mean, when you're, you know, when you're selling out that many Fridays and some of these shows, you've got to think, you know, like the anniversary show or something, they probably could have gone to a stadium and done 35,000 people, or maybe more. We don't know. But they won't. You know, it's a really interesting thing because they're very tradition oriented. And it's a very much older group of people running it. And when that happens, you really don't expect this, you know, you might expect steady business, but you don't expect this giant growth with conservative older bookers. You know what I mean? It's like really, it's really phenomenal. And it's so many things of, so many things have gone into it, you know, and I think that the one also, the other one that I think everyone misses is the thing that I actually wrote about last week is that more Americans attended pro wrestling at Arena Mexico than not only any arena in the United States, but I would bet probably more than attended AEW. I'd have to run the numbers. I could be wrong on that. I know that like, you know, obviously more attend WWE in the United States, but certainly more than attend TNA or anybody else by leaps and bounds because they're doing, you know, if you talk about like 30% of their Friday crowd is outside Mexican audience, it's tourists. So we're talking on a good night, close to 5,000 people, and on a normal night, about 3,000 people.
If you look at the differences here, like Tony Khan is somebody that is not that many years removed from being someone that was actually paying money to go attend wrestling shows. Mm-hmm. And what kind of advantages do you see from that vantage point of someone that's closer to the audience, just in terms of what has worked this generation and what was appealing to me as a fan? Is that a inherent advantage that Tony Khan has that you see?
It's a positive and it's a negative. You know, he has an affinity for a certain product, and it's very, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, the idea that there's no stories, obviously that's ridiculous and all that, but he very much, when he puts together these TV shows, is looking at a TV show to be well regarded by critics, you mm-hmm. know, which, you know, a lot of people in a lot of artist industries do that. In wrestling, it has never been done. I mean, Watts, to a degree, but not Watts was always loyal to the dollar for more than anything. He got a kick out of the fact people liked it. I think all promoters that were, you know, popular at their point, you know, got a kick out of the fact that they got nice feedback from it. But Tony, more than anyone, I mean, he's, I think he's into the feedback, and I think he loves just as, I mean, he is a fan and he loves a certain style of wrestling, and that's the style that he produces. And it's got its pluses and it's got its minuses of doing that. You know, I mean, I think, it's been said to be his weakness, but you know, the people who criticize the most, and if you ask him what he needs to do, it's like copy WWE. And we've seen every number two brand copy WWE. It's never worked. He's had more success than any of them. So I think that at least he's got his niche going out there every Wednesday night and every Saturday, trying to have these matches that are great, which is just, you know, that's the thing that differentiates him. Them and WWE, they're very different, especially like pay-per-view. You know, one's doing a 5-hour show with all kinds of great matches. The other's doing a 3-hour show with 5 or 4 matches, and they're good matches too, but it's a, you know, a lot more time in between matches and things like that. So they're very different products. And I think that's the best thing for all is have a wider choice of products.
I just have two remaining topics. This year, and this is a bit of a loaded question. What did you learn year one of WWE on Netflix and deciphering how well this show is doing, especially in the U.S.? Because I don't think yourself and Brandon Thurston have dug into this very, very extensively this year. How would you assess the move to Netflix? What's worked, what has not worked, and the like 1 year into this deal?
I mean, I think, okay, I will say when it started, you know, and I talked to people in WWE there, you know, like second week, because they were in San Jose, the second show. So that day I was going like, what do you think? And it was very much, I think that the gains are going to be stronger internationally. I think US is probably going to be about the same overall. And US, I think, was down. And international wasn't as big as I expected. So I would say overall, as far as total viewership, I would say I was somewhat disappointed, but at the same time, it's, you know, in the long run, is it going to be better? Yes, there's going to come a point where this viewership is more than what cable viewership is. I thought this year was going to probably be even, and we're not there. Just as the same reason that I don't believe that there's nearly as many people watching on Max as there are on TBS. I do think 5-6 years from now that in both cases that'll be reversed, but we're not quite there yet. But yeah, I was numbers wise, I was expecting more. As far as the show itself, I mean, the one thing early on Netflix, it felt like it was more of a happening, and then it kind of settled down to this is Raw. But those first, I would say 2-3 months, they would come to town with this Netflix special, and you could see the enthusiasm in the crowd that we're on Netflix did mean more than we're on TV. It was cooler, and just the publicity was very positive when it kicked off. But now, at the point we're at now, it's normal. It's just like, yeah, it's Monday Night Raw. It happens to be on Netflix. It's no different from Friday Night SmackDown that happens to be on USA. It's a pro wrestling show. I think it's easier in some ways, but I mean, you know, look, everyone had DVRs. It's not that much easier. You know what I mean? to access later. I mean, long-term, it's the best move. And the other thing too, is from a Netflix standpoint, the one thing that I think we have learned, and it's not from WWE, but it's from the boxing and the MMA negotiations that Netflix had and baseball negotiations, is that I don't think Netflix was happy. They'll never say this publicly, but I don't think they were happy with how it turned out, because the one thing in every set of negotiations they've done is we don't want weekly product. We want 2 or 3 big boxing events a year. We don't want 52 weeks of boxing on Tuesday night. You know what I mean? We don't want Major League Baseball every single week. We want, you know, home run derby, opening game, playoffs, you know, box, you know, like MMA. They basically told UFC, we don't want your Saturday night shows. We'll take the 12 pay-per-views or 13. We don't want anything else. We only want premium content. With WWE, it's 52 weeks of Raw, 52 weeks of SmackDown outside the United States, 52 weeks of NXT, and assorted other programming. So I think that the WWE experiment told them that I don't think they feel their platform should be used for anything but the highest level stuff across the board. So, you know, I
and
mean,
conversely, ESPN's service, I think, much more facilitates that weekly product that would be replacing UFC. Like, I think it'd be interesting if you got the honest answers. Like, it would almost be like Netflix would see the more attractive package being the monthly events. ESPN wants that regularity of coming back every week for Raw or other programming.
Because they're a sports service that relies on regular, constant stuff.
Exactly.
And Netflix is not a sports service, but they want sports premium events that will draw the country. You know, the Joshua fight with Jake Paul. You know, it's like they want the stuff that everyone's talking about to be on their system, but they just don't want to throw random stuff out.
Last thing, we are days away from Wrestle Kingdom 20. I think this is such an important show. It is like, this is one we can talk about the Cena retirement, gigantic success for them, but it's not like the next year was going to hinge on this show succeeding or failing.
All.
This is one like they have what it's a hour, 40 minute, network window. It is the farewell to Tanahashi, but it's also like, here is our audition for what is post Tanahashi New Japan going to be. I can't remember someone having the pressure of an Aaron Wolf on this stage that so much is on. You have Yota Tsuji in a massive match. Like, there's so much to this show that could very well dictate business in 2026. And I find this to be, it's going to be a super compelling show, and it's obviously like this is the most important New Japan show in decades.
I mean, I think that the one with Omega and Jericho was very important for them for international growth. I think that the original Wrestle Kingdom pay-per-view in the United States and Canada was pretty big, but for the Japanese market, I don't even know, because there's other shows that were bigger, but they did not have the long lasting ramifications, you know, like Inoki's retirement. Of course, that's bigger, but you know, they weren't going down the tubes then. They were okay. Now, obviously, and I got to say, I am so disappointed with the lineup. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, I have friends that, I mean, we watch, I couldn't tell you how many years, you know, since New Japan World and since the pay-per-view. So we're probably going back even longer than that. And it's like, we get together at my house and we watch, the Tokyo Dome show live. We stay up till 4 a.m. It's just what we do. And I know that, like, with my friends, the basic thing is we'll watch it in the morning. We don't need to watch it live. And some of them just goes, we'll just watch the Tanahashi and to catch it a match, and that's it. But yeah, Aaron Wolf, I think if Aaron Wolf had not been seen whatsoever, and this was like the first time we'd see him, I think that it might be a lot bigger. But the fact that he's run out in all these angles and stiffed on every one of them, kind of like, I think, has put a giant damper to at least wrestling fans on him. I mean, it's still big to the public because it's a national hero judo gold medalist, you know, in a big time match. But I think that there's now the feeling that he's going to flop, whereas before I think it was the great unknown and the hope that, you know, Tanahashi leaves and the synergy, Tanahashi leaves and he's replaced by the new Tanahashi. And I think that, like, it's probably, you know, I don't think anyone's thinking that anymore.
If you're forecasting a year out, is Okada Yoda-Tsuji the biggest match
Takeshita Yoda-Tsuji?
You're
talking about later.
A year from now, that if Tsuji comes out as sort of the one that's going to avenge Tanahashi, who goes down in his retirement, and Okada is like the representation of the biggest match you can do. I just feel coming out of this, you should at least, you don't have to say it out loud, but at least have an idea of like, what is 2026 going to be about? And to me, it's like, it's Yoda-Tsuji playing off that promo with Tanahashi that I will take the mantle here and move forward. And you have this elusive opponent in Okada that represents him surpassing Tanahashi.
Yes. Yes. I do think that that is probably the biggest thing. I think for New Japan, I think the thing that they really need to do is really try to strengthen the relationships with AEW and get guys, Okada being number one for sure, but maybe even, you know, Moxley or whatever, and get guys to just come in on big shows to put Tsuji over, you know, because they need that ace. And Tsuji beating Uemura and Hirooki Goto and that, it's not going to be enough. But if he beats international stars, he can get there. But he need so international stars, they can't get anyone from WWE. So AEW, and, you know, Tony's a fan of New Japan Pro Wrestling. I don't know what he would do and what he wouldn't do. But to me, you know, from an AEW standpoint, I don't think that Okada going there or Moxley going there or somebody else, you know, anyone else of the top guys, Adam Page, whatever, MJF going there, if they're not the world champion and losing to Tsuji to help build up Tsuji, I don't think that hurts AEW's business one iota. And I think it helps the partners really well.
Well, I don't know if you've realized this, but over the last year, aside from Hogan, who has a huge New Japan component, you would have written about the deaths of Hisashi Shinma, Salman Hashimakov, and excellent story last week on Roland Bach. That was quite a lot of New Japan history that passed away over the last year when you
Shinma, of course. But, you know, Roland Bach, the interesting thing, obviously, is that it's just every aspect of that period in this 1970s is so different and so far removed that, to me, unless you lived it, I don't think you can even put it into comprehend it. And even I, who lived it not on video, just reading about it regularly and remember the, you know, I mean, I remember reading Roland Bach, who I barely knew the name of, beating Antonio Inoki. And it was just like, what the hell? And so I could go back and remember that. And of course, years later, going to Japan, it was such a famous match, you know, and I'd watched it a couple times before, but never with today's eyes. And it's funny watching it now, how I view it. I viewed those matches so differently now than I did then. And some of that is just because, you know, in the 80s, when I'm watching it, you kind of think some things that look real were more real than they were. And they weren't, you know, it's like, it was a work shoot. It was, you know, ahead of its time of what they were doing in UWF years later, that he and Inoki did. It wasn't like great, but it was fascinating. And, you know, it's funny because in Japan, it wasn't like a giant news story there, but to a generation of people who grew up in that period, Roland Bach was like the ultimate man of mystery. And, you know, and then like all week, it was just like, I did not remember Roland Bach wrestling Andre the Giant, but I don't know if it was ever reported in Japan. You know, I mean, I was around in 79. I don't remember it. When I first heard in the Roland Bach obits from Holland about the match where they claimed Roland Bach won, it was just like, oh my God, I don't think there was ever a match. And then later I found out, in fact, that they did have a match in 79. And I'm thinking that like, what a fascinating match. And the reason I'm thinking that is because Japanese people on social media were going like, this was like this elusive match that they never saw that they would have loved to have seen, because it's like, okay, who's going to outpower the other, because they were both so strong in different ways. And, you know, I've only seen photos of it. And, the one thing from the photos is that there was a lot of wrestling in that match. And Roland obviously was the better wrestler of the two.
He is the editor of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. You can catch all of his work over at WrestlingObserver.com. Also want to make mention that his latest complete collection series from 1985 recently released. And I will say that it's a great like tome into wrestling history. But without fail, you can go through a lot of these old issues and there will be something in an issue that will link to the present. And it's really fascinating. It's, you know, from 84, 85, I mean, you can extract a lot of that to, Zuka boxing. Like it's,
yeah, that's a great point. Yeah.
History does not always, repeat, but it does rhyme, quite a lot of times. And that's always something, I take from these. So,
when you say that, the one thing I think is so interesting is I've been criticized so much from boxing reporters, right, that you don't know boxing. And I'm thinking like, because it's not going to change. This is how boxing is. And it's like, I remember living through that and thinking the same. This is how it always is. It's always been territories my entire life. It's always going to be territories. And then all of a sudden, 84, 85, you just realize that the reasons that there were territories have changed. And the reason that boxing had all these fractional promotions have changed. It's a different world, you know, especially with worldwide streaming of big fights and, you know, the Ali Reform Act, that's a story, as you brought up. That's a story that's been, it's not a pro wrestling story, although there's pro wrestling stuff to learn from it. But that's a really underplayed story. And the fact that boxing promoters have talked about it, but they haven't really done anything. Boxers haven't done anything. And it's the MMA community, because they know that they've been screwed by Zuffa pay-wise, that is up in arms about this, because they look at what these boxers make. And now all of a sudden it's like everything that was the reason that Boxing Free Enterprise got the salary so high is on the verge of being taken away. And politicians who just have been, you know, they just don't know. They don't know this, or it's, you know, like they've got bigger fish to fry than the world of pro boxing and how the world of MMA has worked. And, you know, seeing them kind of like, oh, it's the best thing for boxing. And it's the best thing for the promoters of boxing that survive by far. But is it the best thing for boxing and the whole totality of the business and for the other boxing promoters and for the boxers, other than maybe the top guys? It's absolutely not.
Dave, I appreciate this very, very much. I hope you have a great new year, continued success over at WrestlingObserver.com. And thanks a lot for running through some of these stories with us today.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Thanks, John.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit LGUSA.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.